This is writer and game designer Robin D. Laws.
And this is game designer and writer Ken F. Height.
And this is our podcast, Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff.
Bandwidth brought to you by Pelgrane Press.
Stuff we're here to talk about in this episode include...
Paige Turner's Scene Calling.
Ornamental Hermits.
The fantasy film Essentials Wasteland.
And the Grugies.
Well, I sure am glad President Cat greenlit the Catstronauts' mission to expand the International Space Station. I hear he signed the authorization by swatting a pen across the floor. True leadership right there.
Giant laser pointers in space? What's not to like? And even better, the space station has live stream cameras. Although, half the time it's just nose boops. Let's check how the Catstronauts are doing up there on the space station.
Oh man, there goes Waffles the pilot. He's off to see how many kibble bits can achieve orbit around his belly. A pioneer in snackodynamics, that cat.
Here comes the kitty technician, Blanket. Careful, Waffles. If he catches you clogging the air filters with crumbs again, then it's back to litter box duty for you.
Wait a second, Robin. Major Meowser just got a hair-raising transmission from HQ. Is that the new napping module on its way?
Yep, it's their first space station edition. Science Officer Pom Pom better know what to do, or there'll be a... catastrophe in 3, 2, 1.
Here she is, and she's sharpening her claws on the instruction manual. Well, it might accidentally flip to the right page with enough swiping, I guess.
Look at them working together. Waffles is keeping the station steady with his prodigious belly. Blanket is swatting at the module's fasteners like a feather toy. Pom Pom finally found the right instructions, and Major Meowser is, napping on them? Teamwork, by golly!
Hooray for the Catstronauts!
The space station is saved!
Until the next module arrives and starts another near-catastrophe, that is.
Wow, managing your own space station with a crew of feline heroes. Now that's the life!
You know you can, Robin. The official Catstronauts board game is available now from Atlas Games. It's full of pawsome color art by the comic book's creator, Drew Brockington, and Catstronauts features cooperative play that's fun for all ages. Find out more at atlas-games.com/catstronauts.
Sounds like the Catstronauts board game is perfect for the whole family. Let's meet this stellar challenge by picking up the Catstronauts board game now!
The rattle of dice, the thump of miniatures, the crunch of Doritos, and the benevolent gaze of Peter Frampton coming... That's not Peter Frampton, that's Bix Beiderbecke coming alive. That wasn't the rattle of... Well, I guess that was the rattle of dice, but it certainly wasn't the thump of miniatures. That was the thump of a Charleston being danced, and I believe that those were not Doritos that were being crunched. They may have been the bones of people who couldn't pay their gambling debts, because Bix is presiding over a 1920s installment of The Gaming Hut, but one without Cthulhu, one with Jay Gatsby sort of guy, Huck Stanton, because we are in the pages of Page Turners, continuing the scenario The Beacon. Are they called scenarios in Page Turners, Robin?
Yes. And we're not continuing the scenario per se, but we're sort of doing a demo. So if you missed last week's Gaming Hut, go back and listen to it. If you've listened to it but have forgotten it, Page Turners is my new game of dramatic interaction for one GM and one player. And last week we went through the process of the player defining an unmet need for each character. This is a one-to-one version of Hillfolk / drama system. And changing it into having just one player changes the dynamics of several things. And this time we're going to sort of quickly demo, without literally playing, the process of selecting a scene. Because the big obvious difference here is that in a regular game of Hillfolk, you call one out of four or five or six scenes, depending on how many participants there are, including the GM. You get as many turns as everybody else. Here, you have to call every other scene. You have to decide who's in the scene and where it is and what it is that you want from the other character, in this case, always played by the GM. And then the GM calls the other half of the scenes, but they also always have you in it. And the GM in a multiplayer game of Hill Folk only gets as many times at bat as any of the players. Here, again, you have to do much more to drive the story, and there's a lot less sitting back and watching other people just play with the dynamic. Instead of sort of occasionally giving the story a nudge, as you would in Hill Folk, here you are driving it half of the time. As we established last time, this is a kind of a Fitzgerald pastiche, where your character, a guy named Steve Stark, has moved in next to a manor where there's a party going all the time, undoubtedly with Bix Butterbeck often showing up. And you established your relationships to a bunch of the other characters. You have sort of have big ambitions. You've kind of stalled in life, and here's your big chance. And so you haven't met any of the characters except for your increasingly disaffected young wife, Delia. But you're about to meet Huck Stanton, who is the billionaire who rules the roost over at that manor, the Beacon. You've also established how you might relate to Jane Delisle, his straight-laced right hand, Mossy Colbeck, his formidable-looking, scarred assistant of undetermined means or meaning. There's also a starlet named Nell Westerberg. There's your confidant, Abbott Conant, who is a suave, somewhat older imbiber of alcohol. And there's also, you've decided to ignore Ned Reuter, the sullen handyman. And there's also Dorothy Parker, the writer in residence, and you've decided that you might make a play for her in order to get your New York connections going. So in the Beacon, not all of the scenarios specify that the GM starts, not all of them specify a particular scene to start, but this one has an obvious logical starting point, and so it says the GM starts and has Huck Stanton approach Steve for the first time. And typically the way I do this is that Steve's car has broken down by the side of the road. He sees Mossy driving the car, but it's Huck who gets out, and Huck invites him to a party that night at his manor. And so we're not going to play through the scenes in full or do the dialogue, but we're going to indicate whether the petition succeeds or fails. So on this one, Huck is initiating the scene. He's the kind of guy who sees another guy by the side of the road and likes the cut of his jib and invites him to a party. The reason you do that is you're looking for admiration, the thrill of having a favor done for you. So very quickly, Ken, how would Steve react to that?
Depending on how, is Delia in the car and giving me crap, or is it just me in the car?
Delia is not in the car.
Okay. In that case, Steve would forbear trying to fix the car unless it's super obvious and easy, like a wire came loose or a distributor cap is jogged loose. If it's not immediately obvious how to fix the car, just pay attention to Huck, and in a sort of we're all men here next to an engine type mode, accept his kind invitation. That'd be great. The wife will be so excited. She's been listening to the party and can't wait to come.
And so in this version of the scene, clearly you've given Huck the approbation he wants by accepting the invitation. It's an easy case of the GM character has gotten what they want. You gave them what they want. And so you get a drama token.
Yay.
In page turners, unlike Hill Folk, you don't start out with zero tokens. You each start out with three. Turns out to be necessary to sort of grease the wheels a little. So now you've got four drama tokens. And so the thing that I want to focus on, though, is how we decide what scenes to play next. So what scene would you then decide to play after that?
I feel like the next scene is telling Delia that we're invited to the party in the mansion. And what I would want from Delia is a sort of recognition that that was an accomplishment and that I have succeeded already in beginning our climb back up to the top.
And that also is the clearly obvious scene that almost always follows if the main character is in fact Steve instead of Delia. And so the way I play this as GM is to initially give a bit of resistance, and then as she realizes that the Beacon might indeed be the place for her dreams to be realized, she is happy and satisfied that this has happened, and she gives Steve the support and thanks that he is looking for.
So then the token would go back to you, right?
The token would go back to me. So as GM, I then decide whether what the next thing is that makes sense to have happen. And we want to move the story along. So I would then flash forward into the two of you heading into the party. And I'm going to introduce a symbol of Steve's desire for success. And so after describing the party scene, with all of its 1920s bacchanal, you would then run into Dorothy Parker, who you've heard of. And Dorothy Parker, as you've indicated, might be interested in Steve because he is a handsome guy and a rat like many of her real life boyfriends. So in this scene, she's going to, several martinis in, come to Steve and just try to figure out who is this handsome guy who has suddenly appeared, unlike the other handsome guys who she already knows who they are at this party. Mm-hmm. And so how would Steve give her the spark of interaction she's looking for?
Yes. If Steve is still with Delia, if Delia is still on his arm, then obviously the move is to introduce Dorothy Parker to Delia and keep it polite on the surface. Lots of, do you know such and such a person that I barely know from my PR in New York, to establish a common rapport and then ease into the rapport in a way that says, once my wife is not here, then we can talk more seriously about literature and drinking in New York. So yes, but yes, in a subtle way, not a mashery way.
Right. He's been forced to class up his act by having his wife on his arm.
Exactly. It is so true of so many of us.
Right. And so that returns the calling to you. What scene would you then choose to call?
I feel like the next bounce off is going to be with Jane Delisle, because Steve is now going to be going across the party looking for access to Huck. You know, ostensibly, thank you for the invitation to your lovely party. What a great house. But also to establish camaraderie. But of course, before he can get to Huck, Jane Delisle's whole job is to keep people like Steve away from Huck. So obviously she's going to intercept me with whatever she has in her mind. And my goal is Jane Delisle's rapid acceptance of my worthiness to be here and be buddies with Huck.
Well, things have gone kind of well for Steve so far. And since this is not a procedural about succeeding, but a drama about facing your limitations, I'm going to decide to play Jane as resistant to you and kind of suspicious, and also maybe gives a hint of that the invite here has not been entirely without ulterior motive. So Steve is going to leave that one somewhat disappointed. And that's then going to put me back in the position of calling a scene. And I'm going to increase the stakes even further by you realizing that as you've been having this conversation trying to get to Huck, the person who has gotten to Huck already is Delia. And they seem to be hitting it off perhaps too well.
Too well.
And so I'm going to call a scene in which you are going to get kind of jealous and ask Delia exactly why she has taken mere minutes to attach herself to the host of the party.
And am I doing this in the presence of Huck, or am I, have I pried her loose?
I'm going to say, in order to really let loose, that you're going to pull her aside into an alcove.
Right. So I've pried her loose on the pretense of going to the punch bowl, and instead we're behind one of the enormous full-size palm trees in the house, and I'm like, giving her the what for. This isn't about you. This is about us. How dare you? He's not going to have his head turned by some cheap Kansas City approach. He needs to be handled man to man. And how, what do you think you're doing? So we need her to get back in line, Robin. That's what we need as Steve.
Right. And of course, Delia does not get back in line at all. She indicates that she's the one who knows what she's doing here. And perhaps you're a fifth wheel, and deflates that wheel pretty thoroughly. And so that then gives you the question of what scene you would then decide to call after that setback.
All right. I feel like this is where Abbot Conant, who's been watching all of this and is my confidant character, is going to take pity and sort of, I think at first Abbot is saying, this is your chance just to get out with what you've accomplished. But obviously Steve's a pinhead and won't do that. But Abbot will at least fill Steve in on the necessary knowledge to survive not just his first Huck Stanton party, but several Huck Stanton parties to come.
As always with the confidant character, he attempts to unruffle your feathers. He wants to help, and he gives you a couple of pointers, one of which is that this is a common occurrence with Huck, is that he finds himself attracted to women. Women find themselves attracted to him. You've got to play it smooth if you want to survive here, and you need to get in the sweep of the party if that's what you want. If not, You might want to grab Delia and get as far away from the beacon as you possibly can. And he also kind of hints that maybe Huck has something in store for you, and you might want to say yes, but you also might want to be careful. And that then, I think it's about time that you talk to Huck again. And so we're going to cut to your conversation with Huck, where he welcomes you. You can't tell whether he has seen you react to his interaction with Delia and is trying to calm you down, or he's just trying to be a swell host. But he comes up, he puts a drink in your hand, and he sort of indicates that he's always looking for people who can do things for him, and he has lots of opportunities at his disposal. And so are you receptive to this?
Oh, heck yes. This is the whole point.
So once again, you've given Huck what he wanted.
Yep.
And once again, the scene calling turns back to you.
Okay. Well, two can play at that game, Delia. I'm going to let Nell Westerberg see me and play into Nell. And what I want from Nell is physical admiration that Delia can see from across the room.
Right. And so this is an instance of the original unmet need that you thought you'd established in our segment last week, was that you're going to try and pair up Nell and Delia as buddies.
Right.
But here, the story's gone in a different way. And what's important is to observe what is in the story, not what you thought was going to happen. And right. So we forget that. There's now a new, obvious, implicit desire for something. And in this case, Nell kind of gives you the fade. She kind of gives you the high hat. She gives you the cold shoulder.
Not the high hat.
Not the high hat, because her eyes are still on Huck. So not only does Delia see you make a play for Nell, but she watches you get shot down in real time.
No. What a disaster. Who could have seen that coming except for literally anyone?
So at this point, you then sort of head off. You've been deflated, and you can see sort of a smile on the lips of Dorothy Parker. And she gives you that sort of ambivalent look that maybe you're even more interesting to her now that you've been knocked down a peg or two.
Yeah.
How do you respond to her?
I think that we will have that promised lengthy talk about New York and the people that I briefly knew that she obviously knows well. And I'm going to play it off as, well, these things, worst things happen in war. That's the way the, you know, you take the dice, you throw them, etc. Too cool for Nell, and obviously return her guarded interest with flattering returned interest, because this is still something that Steve feels that he's good at.
Right. And that brings us to your scene, which you will then call.
I feel like confident as a result of my talk with Dorothy, then the natural thing to call is Mossy Colbeck has heard that Huck is offering me an unspecified gig. Mossy is in charge of unspecified gigs, does not want some loose cannon, as Steve clearly is, messing up. Mossy shows up to sort of give me what Mossy considers to be a polite warn-off, but Steve has been at the party for a great length of time and still is feeling sensitive in his masculinity. And so, therefore, I feel like this could lead to a physical confrontation, or it could lead to Steve taking advantage of the social insulation of the party to give Mossy the high hat. But either way, this is a Steve versus Mossy moment. And obviously Steve wants to win, because that's what Steve wants.
Right. And in response to that, what I would do is jump ahead in time to the next morning, to your hangover, and to a knock at the door. And at the door is Mossy Colbeck. He's looking somewhat chastened, somewhat annoyed, and he says that, in fact, he's come to sound you out on a proposal on behalf of Huck, and he asks if you've ever been to Cuba before. And so that is where we're going to end this example of scene calling. In actual play, of course, you would play out the full dialogue scenes, and you would possibly discover things as you played the scenes that would change the order. That the fact that we're doing this in truncated fashion means that we've come to the obvious end of each scene rather than one that you've discovered midway. In actual play, it might go in quite a different direction, even with those original scenes being called the same way. But that sort of shows you how you have to keep moving and keep thinking and keep pushing this story forward yourself as the protagonist, or as the GM presenting obstacles to the protagonist in a way that you wouldn't in Hill Folk. And on that note, having wrapped up that little bit of the demo, and of course, in a real game, it would last 2 to 4 hours, and what you would have heard would be the scenes maybe for the first book. Often scenarios are divided into 3 books, and then things would start to take a turn, and you could see the turn coming as Steve's gets an offer that he has to decide whether he wants to refuse or not. But the one thing we can't refuse is to keep moving through this podcast, so I'm going to call a commercial, and after that, another Hut and/or segment.
Moving drama.
Hilarious comedy.
And you are the sole protagonist.
Page Turners is my game of personal storytelling for one player and one GM.
Coming soon from Pelgrane Press.
Longtime listeners know Hillfolk, my game of dramatic group play.
Winner of the coveted Diana Jones Award.
Page Turners shifts its dynamic down to the intimate scale of a single main character whose fiction you weave on the fly with one other creator.
Shockingly simple rules keep the focus on emotional interaction.
Extensive guidance helps you shape satisfying outcomes.
Writers Sarah Sam Saltiel, Wade Rocket, and Ruth Tillman join Robin in presenting 11 scenarios spanning a wealth of genres and tones.
Scenarios include
Jazz Age Ambition and Glamour,
A Childhood Haunted by Strife and a Shadowy Being,
Deceit and Survival on the Spaceship Earth Again,
A Stay in Bath takes an unexpected turn in the Austen-inspired Entreaty and Entanglement,
The Screwball 30s Hijinks of Loose Screws,
The Shakespearean Comedy of Love's Loyal Laborers,
A Love Triangle Unfolding from the Turbulent 60s to the Troubled 20-teens,
Behind the Music Drama in the L.A. Punk Scene,
The Arrival of a Telepathic Stranger on a Spacebound Way Station,
Tragic Love Between a Vampire and a Mortal,
and an epic multi-generational saga of artificial beings attempting to build a civilization in the tradition of that extinct species, Homo sapiens.
Gorgeously laid out and illustrated by graphic superstar Jen McCleary.
Whoever you want to be, wherever your imagination takes you.
Whether your journey leads to Union Doom or something harder to define.
Page Turners unleashes your story in new and unexpected ways.
The funny looking wigs. The different costumes. The highfalutin diction tell us that we're once more in the past, once more in the History Hut. And this time around, we're going to look at a thing I recently discovered existed and turns out to be fascinating and full of weird detail. And that is ornamental hermits. And we can't even talk about the circumstances of the Pelgrane social virtual hangout that led us to Gar telling us about ornamental hermits, because that in itself would be an entire other segment. But there's too much to get to, so we're going to dispense with how we got there and start out, Ken, with a look at one of the weirdest conventions or traditions I've come across in a long while.
Yeah, this is a lot of the information that we're about to unfold here. I have peeled out of a book called The Hermit in the Garden, From Imperial Rome to Ornamental Gnome by Gordon Campbell.
It's the best subtitle.
We are cutting off the Imperial Rome and the Ornamental Gnome halves, because those are, I don't feel, particularly well-supported arguments. We're going to start with the actual notion of the hermit. And the hermit, of course, began
so
as...
Let me interrupt. Did you have this on your shelf already, or did you acquire it?
I went and found a copy of it in the internet, and now I have it on my shelf. But it's my virtual shelf.
So I guess before you can have hermits, you need a hermitage. What is a hermitage and where does the tradition come from?
The hermitage is, you'll be surprised to know, a place a hermit lives, or an establishment that allows hermits to live there if they're multiple hermits. There are multiple hermit hermitages, but a hermit is someone who removes themselves from the world for purposes of religious contemplation. You go into the desert as Christ does in his teaching and his ministry, and you meditate or pray or mortify your own flesh. You live a simple ascetic life, not distracted by the world, so that you can become closer to God, either in understanding or in mystical attainment. And hermitages are therefore part of the monastic tradition. They are solo by design rather than mutual by design. And they go back to late antiquity. St. Anthony of the desert is probably considered the first hermit, and he's roughly 250-ish AD. And eventually, as fashions change, hermits, they spring up a great deal in the Dark Ages. As the Middle Ages begins to thrive, and as Christian scholars and mystics have more and more important place in society, fewer and fewer people are driven to hermitage. But even in late medieval times, there would still be a couple of few hermits just sort of scattered around any big population area. And the local aristocrat, if he was a mensch, would provide them a living that was also separate from town. So if there was a bridge on the outskirts of town, he'd put up a hermitage by the bridge and let the hermit live in the bridge house. And he would sort of keep an eye on the bridge and let people know if it flooded or whatever. Or he would be given the job of clearing a well after like a heavy, you know, rain or whatever. But otherwise he wouldn't really have a job, and he'd just be living out by the well. And you'd kind of support them as an example of your aristocratic noblesse oblige. And so people are used to hermits as part of the universe. The legendary hero Guy of Warwick, or Guy de Warwick, since he began in French language, returns home and disguises himself as a hermit, and he lives in a cave near his old domain until he dies. And so the notion of a great man retiring to become a hermit is sort of in the air as well. In the Renaissance, they began to build these large gardens, which were recapitulating both nature and civilization, depending on how far north your garden was. If they're recapitulating civilization, you obviously need a hermitage. If they're recapitulating nature, what better thing to put than a hermitage? And so they started building a hermitage into the gardens of Chateau de Gaillon in 1508. That was the first big Renaissance house to have a hermit. That royal fashion in France spreads to Hungary and Burgundy. King Charles V of Spain legitimately wants to pull a Guy of Warwick and become a hermit. He's had too much stress running a global empire and everything else. So he builds his own hermitage. And because the king has built a hermitage, Spanish great houses all built hermitages so that they could, you know, pretend that they were like the king and get a retire. Some of them actually do. So hermits are sort of an established appanage of a great estate, even though you don't actually have a hermit there. Robert Cecil from episode 635 welcomes Queen Elizabeth to his house in 1591 with a poetic speech that was ostensibly crafted by the local hermit. It's called The Hermit's Welcome. You can still read it. And there was no hermit. The hermit is a poetic hermit. He was the, you know, observer of the grounds.
A pseudo hermit, if you will.
Right, exactly. Sir Francis Bacon has a staff member, Thomas Bushell, who is an expert in mining. And when Bacon is impeached as chancellor, Bushell shows his innocence by becoming a hermit. And he retires to an island in 1621 and spends 3 years on the hermit island. And then he marries a rich heiress and builds his own hermitage on his estate. And Charles I visits him in his hermitage. And so that adds the royal imprimatur to the continental tradition of having a hermitage on your estate.
And does the heiress know that she's getting a hermit who's going to go and live in his hermitage instead of be with her?
I feel like the heiress has sort of like priced in everything wrong with Thomas Bushell when she marries him.
Perhaps it's a feature that he's going to go and live.
Yeah, I mean, at some level, if Thomas Bushell is not hanging around whining about how Francis Bacon was railroaded, you probably count it as a plus, I assume.
Right. So there's a lot of crossovers with previous episodes. And here's one that crosses over with episode 184.
Yeah, because Count Franz Anton von Spork is the leading proponent of hermitages on the continent by now. And he's the founder of the Hunting Order of St. Hubertus, which we discuss in that episode. And he builds 5 hermitages on his estate of Kuksch in Bohemia. His estate is built around a spa, so people who come to the spa need to be able to see a hermit wherever they are. And this is sort of the next step in hermitry. He invites actual religious brothers and hermits to come live on his estate. And this is fairly late. Between the Reformation and the Counter-Reformation, the hermit gig is much harder to come by.
Right. Well, this is awesome. This can't possibly go wrong.
No, it can't, unless 60% of your hermits turn out to be heretics. Oh, no. And that's the reason they needed to get away from everybody.
Heretical ornamental hermits.
Yes, it's the worst. They're accused of heresy. They're taken off and tried and executed. So Count von Spork replaces those hermits with statues of hermits, which I think is it's pretty smart, Count von Spork. Well done.
Your statue of hermit can't be accused of heresy.
You cannot. It's very, very hard. Although Count von Spork was accused of heresy because at some point people looked at his library and said, you own a lot of forbidden books, Count von Spork. And he had to sort of do a little tap dancing to get away from that. But anyway, this notion of the Enlightenment hermit spreads to England. William Stukeley, the known antiquarian from episode 585, he builds not just a druid nook or druid grotto on his estate, but a proper garden hermitage in England. And this is in 1727. So this is the first known garden hermit as opposed to rich guy retirement cottage on his own property hermitage that we have in England. And that sets off a fad. Queen Caroline gets a garden hermitage in 1730. The Viscount Cobham gets one in 1731. The fad blows up by 1750. More country houses that are being built have hermitages than don't. It's almost a standard, you know, it's like bucket seats. You get your hermitage, you get your fountain, you get your gazebo, you get your hedge maze, they're all there. And the notion is that the hermitage is something that you come upon as you're touring the garden. The garden is meant to give you different emotional qualities. There's the happy part of the garden with the apples and the flowers, and then there's the melancholy part of the garden. And as you are entered the melancholy part with the pine trees and whatnot, and you think, woe is the earth, woe is me, then you come upon the hermitage and you realize that you must contemplate this melancholy and its role in the world. And there's nothing that the Enlightenment loved more than making a big deal out of melancholy. So I think that's another reason that hermitages became a thing, is that you could sit and contemplate melancholy there. And it was very intellectually useful and stimulating. So in 1760, the Honorable Charles Hamilton, or roughly 1760, we don't actually have a date for this, hires a hermit for his own garden at Painshill. He is the guy who takes the step and actually hires a guy to be a hermit. And this is not a religious hermit. It's just a guy. And the trouble is that when you hire just a guy, his name is Remington, as it happens. He lasts about 3 weeks and he goes to a bar, and then they catch him at the bar. And that's not very hermity of him. So he's fired.
Possibly better than heresy.
Yeah, it is better than heresy, but it's still not a good look.
No.
The naturalist Gilbert White has an estate at Selborne. He builds two different hermitages. The nicer one, people seem to believe, is the first one, 1765. His 1776 hermitage, not as much spirit in it. But anyway, it's his younger brother, Harry, would just dress up as the local hermit when they would have parties. And so that, I guess, is a way of solving the problem of what do you do with a hermit in the off season? Just have your brother do it.
Right.
But that's not quite the same thing.
It's more of a cosplay hermit.
That's a cosplay hermit, yes, as you say. So every so often, you have a lot of hermitages. You don't have so many hermits. At Wamborne in Staffordshire, they built an automaton hermit, and he would just sit in the hermitage. And then when you'd come up, he'd sort of turn around and, you know, put his glasses on, and everyone would go, oh my goodness, it's a hermit. And that statue was named, or that automaton rather, was named Father Francis. And I think that became sort of the fashionable name of hermits. If you didn't have a name for your hermit, you called him Father Francis, because in 1784, the Lord of the Manor at Hawkstone in Shropshire hired a hermit named Father Francis. And this hermit lasted from 1784 to 1811. And he was very old when he showed up. And at some point, you know, either the pains of age or just the actual Father Francis, you know, died, they replaced him with a stuffed hermit or with a hermit automaton. But unlike the 1765 Wamborne automaton, this hermit could talk and he would greet you. And guests would say, I assume that's the gardener, but no one ever proved. They didn't open up the hermit and discover a small boy doing a hermit voice or anything like that. He also had a druid in his grotto that also was sometimes an automaton and sometimes a guy dressed as a druid. But I think that was more garden staff dressing as the druid than a full-time druid, the way that Father Francis would be a full-time hermit. And then he enjoyed Father Francis so much that when the automaton wasn't working, he had a bunch of hermits named Jones, and the Jones family just passed the hermit job down amongst them. And Hawkstone's hermits were so famous that in a parody, someone said that the future editor of the Monthly Review served his time. That's how he became such a good journalist, was he began as the hermit at Hawkstone. That's probably making fun of the future editor.
That does sound like that.
Yeah, it's a bit. A guy named Joseph Pocklington puts in an advertisement for a hermit in 1790. The hermit is never to leave the place or hold conversation with anyone for 7 years, during which he is neither to wash himself or cleanse himself in any way whatsoever, but is to let his hair and nails on both hands and feet grow as long as nature will permit them. And Tom Stoppard's play Arcadia, which involves a ornamental hermit, points out, but surely a hermit who takes a newspaper is not a hermit in whom one can have complete confidence.
Yes. Now, this is not just an old world thing. It goes to America as well and takes on an American flavor. So by the 1800s, New England has a thriving hermit-based tourist trade. There are pamphlets celebrating the virtues, the moral virtues of various local hermits, and trekkers will seek out the best backwoods eccentrics in order to speak with. Sometimes they would fix things for you. Sometimes they would run a tavern, which seems to be, you know, in the entrepreneurial spirit of America, stretching the concept a little. The fad was kicked off by the discovery of Sarah Bishop, who lived in a cave, and in the late 1790s, she was found at age 27. That's an entirely crazy story in and of itself, in that she had gone to live in a cave with only a Bible and some rags and a gourd that she cooked in after having been kidnapped by the hated British and forced into piracy, which is why you would then be sufficiently traumatized to go live in a cave. But at any rate, people kept bothering her. Like, journalists would show up and write about her after she died. There was an ode to her that was written. And therefore, this put the idea of hermits in people's minds. She was not ornamental in any way. She was genuinely trying to get away from people and live in a cave. But this kicked off this whole fad for what then became sort of a performative hermitry. So this idea also went to America, but interacted with the idea of the woods and the idea of people, instead of this is on your state, they're really living in a forest, but you go and visit them. And sometimes they're unhappy to see you, and other times they fix something for you or get you a drink or sell you some merchandise.
Sort of the hermit as theme park.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. In 1810, speaking of newspapers, and this is back in England, a young man advertises in the Plymouth Courier for a position as an ornamental hermit. We have two extant requests by someone to be hired as a hermit, which implies that there are many, many more. But again, we don't know if he was hired ever.
There's one guy who becomes sort of the archetypal ornamental hermit without really doing it for very long, because he is later written up in a book by Edith Sitwell, which is a survey of English eccentrics. This is the former army captain and then travel writer and also mean-spirited pamphleteer, Philip Thicknesse. And he, late in his life, in around the early 1820s, he builds a hermitage for himself in Bath. And this turns out kind of to be part of his shtick, as being sort of a famous annoying person, which a job that has come back recently, not the hermit part, but the famous annoying part. Anyway, he briefly engaged in hermitry before returning to his usual scandalous behavior, because once you've done the bit of being a hermit, you've got to find new stuff to do.
He was like a hermit influencer.
Yes, exactly. He dies in 1823. And at that point, he orders that his right hand be cut off and sent to his son, George, as a reproach for his inattentiveness. But at any rate, this guy winds up being sort of the Sitwell chooses him as the ornamental hermit to talk about, even though he was only briefly engaged in that.
And is not a true ornamental hermit because he's self-employed. And again, that's not the job. There's a guy named Charles Evans who went by the name of Carolus. That was his hermit name. He was the hermit of Tong Castle. There's paintings of him. He dies in 1825, but he may have just been a weirdo who squatted in the hermitage on the gardens, and that they let him do it. But also, the debauched Lord of Tong, George Durant Esquire, had sort of hellfire club parties with, you know, debauching. His guests would dress as monks, and the ladies that would be invited would be dressed as nuns, and festivities would go on. And maybe Carolus also sort of took a hand in running that and, you know, getting drinks and calming down the more rowdy people and generally being the party cooler as needed be. So we're not sure what the relationship between Carolus and George Durant, Lord Tong, would be, but certainly there's something going on there. There is a fellow named Colonel Thomas Bradill, and he keeps a hermit at his estate in Conishead in Lancashire, and that's from 1828 to 1848. He becomes good friends with his hermit, and they hang out and have a great time for 20 years because Colonel Bradill's a good guy. You may be wondering what the pay for an ornamental hermit is. From the pay records that we have or the advertisements that we have pay ranging from £50 a year, which is £14,000 now, which is not great, I think, but room and board, all the way up to £300 a year. And that's like 85 grand, and that's good. And then some would get as much as £700, but you'd have to serve the whole 7 years as a hermit and get paid in the lump sum at the end. So that's a little more of a, you know, challenge.
Yeah.
Because not everyone is cut out, it turns out, for ornamental hermitry, Robin. It's the few of the proud, really.
Right. And I would be wondering whether my patron is going to stiff me at the end of the 7 years or die off and have an uninterested son then take over. So
yeah,
that seems like a bad arrangement all around.
Yeah. And it only comes down to, like I say, you know, £28,000 now, which again, I suppose, you know, a nice starting job, but it's not, you don't want to build a career on that. They had a fortune-telling hermit who replaced a painting of a hermit in the Vauxhall Pleasure Gardens, which, speaking of being their own segment, but he and his successors worked Vauxhall from 1821 till 1859 when they tore the gardens down. And that's sort of well past the fad for hermits. So this is like a, you know, weren't our ancestors funny? Come pay money to get your fortune told by their hermit type. It's not a serious hermiting. It's a funny pretend hermit.
Well, in Scotland, no one's told people that there aren't real ornamental hermits anymore, because all the way up to 1866, there's a man named John Smith. He has a number of hermiting gigs at different manors, and it's only in 1866.
Itinerant hermit, which boggles the mind.
Right. I guess maybe you get a letter of recommendation from the previous guy. I don't know how that works, but at any rate, in 1866, he has a romantic setback, which suggests he's not entirely hermiting, and moves to a cave in Irving, Massachusetts. And that revives the New England interest in hermitry. He's now hermiting on his own dime, except he's following the American tourist attraction model in that when people show up, if they're nice to him, and not everybody is, some punks vandalize his cave at some point, which I disapprove of that, I have to say. But if you're nice to him, he'll talk to you, he'll discuss things, and also sell you copies of his biography or his poetry. So yeah, 1867 onwards, that's relatively recent for this.
I do want to sort of maybe suggest that, like many immigrants to America, he might have exaggerated his connection to nobility in the past. I don't know that we have a lot of evidence for a guy named John Smith, of all things, being an ornamental hermit in Scotland in the early part of the 19th. Although it's not impossible, because as Gordon Campbell says resentfully, there just aren't enough records of ornamental hermits, given the amount of ornamental hermiting that we can adduce must have been going on. So for every anecdote that we have, you can imagine, you know, 6 or 8 other ornamental hermits, you know, rolling around the countryside, getting up to adventures, or ideally not at all getting up to adventures. So your ornamental hermit from a boundary of the darkness or wherever else you want to insert him can certainly show up without anyone being able to give you the eye about it. And now, of course, arts community has ruined hermiting by making it a grad student thing. So people come and be hermits for performance art reasons or to make a political point, or basically the tradition of annoying people by being hermits remains alive. And once more, it is people who can't get a real job who have to go guard a bridge. And instead of the local landowner paying for it, it's some quango. So there we are. Right. Hermiting has begun as tragedy and ended in farce, just like everything does.
So at any rate, in a fantasy world, this indicates that you can run into ornamental hermits in the gardens of the great lords, and perhaps they will provide you with information or have magical amulets to protect you, or can assist or hinder you in various ways in a period occult investigation thing. As we've established, even into the 19th century, you can again run into hermits perhaps performative hermits. In the US, they might be sort of tourist attraction hermits. But again, they can have information or items of power or insights into the other realms they see with their meditative activities.
Yeah, it's, you know, often the hermits would be part of a menagerie, especially on the continent. And the hermit in, I believe it was the one in Hoxton, also had a menagerie around him. So in a fantasy realm, you could imagine the king with his garden or the great lord with his garden. He's got one of each. He's got a hermit human. He's got a hermit elf. He's got a hermit dwarf. He's got a hermit gnome. You know, that could be the beginning of the garden gnome right there, is that maybe in your fantasy world, gnomes, when they fall on hard times, they go and they job as hermits for rich folk. And maybe that's why the tricksy gnome actually, you know, he got good at illusioning, is because he needs to cast an illusion of himself being a proper hermit while he can go off and have adventures.
Right. Well, speaking of adventures, it's time for us to have another adventure in this podcast and another hat and or segment. In the spiral.
Four scenarios embrace the works and deaths of agents between 2016 and 2020, years called the Spiral and the Delta Green Campaign, God's Teeth.
That span of cruelty and corruption in American government seemed a bitter interregnum.
A momentary eruption of spite.
Now it stands revealed as a preparation for revelations to come.
In God's eye, a baffling disappearance leads the agents to confront the inexorable government panopticon.
They face unnatural revelations unleashed by the death of privacy.
And must survive desperate revenge beneath the sleepless skies.
In God's breath, a Delta Green friendly leaves a frantic voicemail about a Denver prisoner vomiting up an alien worm.
Your agents must identify the unnatural threat.
Trace it to its source.
Burn it out.
Just be careful of the smoke.
In God's law, a shockingly gruesome death leads the agents to a Los Angeles police gang.
It has twisted older, deeper laws towards the tired avarice of corruption.
How far do the agents go to resist the unnatural?
In God's light, the wreckage left by a mass shooter catches Delta Green's attention.
Somehow behind it, a surprising app that reaches strange places on the border between worlds.
The scenarios of God's Hunt are playable with Arc Dream Publishing's Delta Green, the role-playing game.
Play the scenarios on their own, as a cycle, or as a perfect companion to the acclaimed campaign Delta Green, God's Teeth.
Learn more about Delta Green at delta-green.com.
Help this podcast support its hermit, as do generous Patreon backers.
Chris Farrell.
James Kiley.
John Buckley.
Justin Moharab.
And Peter Darby.
Once more, we make our way through the increasingly empty lobby, down the increasingly ill-designed corridor. The seats are nicer because they're finally those recliners, but we are definitely in the 2010s, the 2020s. We're settled in to our middle seats in our middle row, probably watching a crappy digital projection of a fantasy film essential. And this is sort of the memento mori, there used to be fantasy. Sometimes we still get it. Sometimes it's even still good. But you'll note that we're doing two whole decades now instead of, you know, 1 year. So the speed has dropped. Our popcorn is popping much more intermittently than it used to, I would say. Right. Robin?
There's a couple of factors at work here. One is that there's still fantasy movies being made, but they're part of big franchises, which are often sort of clunky, and neither of us love them enough to endorse them. The good Thor movie would count if we hadn't moved superheroes into its own category. Also, the DVD sales dive has happened. That's around 2008 when sales of DVDs dropped through the floor, and there's a big period where there's no funding model for mid-sized films, which is where you would get the ghost comedies or other fantasy comedies or things that are not giant epics. That sort of drops away in Hollywood in particular. and it's going to take a while for the indie scene to deliver any fantasy movies. Before we get started, there's an honorable mention that you want to give people.
Yeah, I want to throw a mention of Bahubali, which is a two-part fantasy epic. India has made many, many, many movies about some aspect of the Mahabharata. Bahubali is their most recent, most acclaimed fantasy epic. It's from 2015 and 2017, directed by S.S. Rajamouli. I have not seen it, nor has Sheila, but it is one of the things that, much like we mentioned Miyazaki all the way at the beginning of this and then said neither of us are going to cop to being Miyazaki experts, if we had seen Bahubali, there's a chance it would be on here, and I did want to give it a shout out because there is a national film culture that is still trying to do fantasy films, and good for you, India, but sadly...
Right. And there's also the question of, if it's the Mahabharata, is it really fantasy, or is it a depiction of somebody's faith?
Well, you can do the Mahabharata in all manner of different directions. You could do it as a semi-historical, you can do it as a love story, you can do... It's a gigantic epic. But this one is definitely, you can understand from the way it's talked about that this is Tollywood saying, well, Lord of the Rings may be all fancy and that, but we can do that, and we can do it with something real like the Mahabharata. And so it's in the dialogue with Lord of the Rings. And so I would put it in the genre.
So let's start with some things we've actually seen and endorse. I'm going to start with Rare Exports, A Christmas Tale from 2010, directed by Jalmari Helander. It's a Finnish movie. I said there were two good Santa Claus movies. This is because this Santa Claus is Krampus.
Yes.
This is a kid who loves Santa, realizes that there's a corporation coming to dig into the nearby mountain. Turns out they're digging in the mountain to release the tomb of Santa, but Santa turns out to be Krampus. This is a great kid-focused yet still dark fantasy film with a great escalation and payoff at the end. The tagline in the American trailer, "You better watch out," is very apt, has a delightful feeling of black comedy, and does more than deliver on the concept. So another Christmas movie, but the Santas are not as Santa-like as one might expect.
Yeah, and he's not technically Krampus. He's a different, you know, notion of a primordial god of winter who has been called Santa later on, but it's very much the, you know, Nyarlathotep behind Santa as opposed to just, you know, specifically Austrian Krampus. But it is, as you say, a delight, and it's a great horror comedy as well, which is something that is also not done as often as it might be. So good for it. And you, unlike me, were a big fan of Uncle Bunmi Who Can Recall His Past Lives. I guess, is this the beginning of that slow cinema, or is this the fast that he does before he gets slow?
No, this is definitely his version of slow cinema, which is not new at this point in 2010. The director is Apichatpong Weerasethakul, and this is a movie. It's set in the depths of the jungle. There's basically three main characters. There's Uncle Bunmi, who is dying. There's Hue, who's the ghost of his wife, who comes back to warn him that heaven is overrated. There's nothing going on there. And also his long-lost son comes back, and that's Boonsong. And he returns, however, in the form of a red-eyed, furry, Sasquatch-like cryptid-slash-spirit being. This is a slow, meditative, dreamlike film, possibly even better seen if you're sort of on the edge of falling asleep, in which you'll sort of dream your way into the film. There's a famous sequence that recounts a folktale of a disfigured princess who falls for a catfish, or rather perhaps has a dalliance with a magical catfish. It is I don't love slow cinema in general, but this is one that absolutely works for me. In order for it to work, it has to be magical, and this one is magical and definitely needs to be mentioned in the context of fantasy films from this era.
And the opposite of slow cinema would be Patrick Lussier's 2011 Soul Escapes from Hell version of the angel comedy, Drive Angry. And Lussier is, I think, a disciple of Luc Besson, right? And this one, if that wasn't enough, stars Nicolas Cage. So, Robin,
yes.
I haven't even seen this movie. Tell us why Drive Angry is essential as opposed to just being great.
Yeah, so this is one that I think a lot of people slept on this because Nicolas Cage does a lot of weird-seeming movies, and some of them are not great, but this one is fabulous. It's sort of a high-octane action film that plays with the hell and devil mythology. Nicolas Cage is John Milton, who returns from hell to rescue his infant granddaughter, who's been kidnapped by a Satanist played by Billy Burke, who intends to...
Not the John Milton, just a John Milton.
He lives in the modern day, so his granddaughter... Yeah,
he didn't write Paradise Lost and then suddenly go to hell. It's a different guy.
Right, but the name is not an accident, of course.
Right, yeah.
And so he returns to Earth on a mission of rescue. He gets a ride from his then sidekick, Piper Lee, played by Amber Heard. And in pursuit of him is William Fichtner as the accountant, the person who gets dispatched when people jump out of hell. He also delivers a really great, wry, funny performance. There's a lovely little moment where he informs the Satanist character that Satan hates Satanists. And the action is really great. It's genuinely funny. Nicolas Cage, despite the weirdness of the movie and it being a Nicolas Cage movie, is rather restrained. He's in sort of a wisecracking action hero mode because that's what the role calls for. So amid a whole bunch of Nicolas Cage movies where he was pitched, yeah, this one's kind of weird. You had me at weird. And he jumps in. This is the really great Nicolas Cage movie that people don't know, Drive Angry.
And skipping ahead 9 years, we come to a movie that I know that you like better than me. I thought it was Amuse-Bouche. You think it goes deeper than that. So tell us why Palm Springs, starring the lovely and talented Andy Samberg, is an essential time loop movie instead of just a time loop movie.
So this is directed by Max Barbacow. So the twist on the time loop movie is that other people are in the time loop with you. And Andy Samberg's character, Niles, starts the time loop every morning on the day of a wedding. And he's been in the time loop for a while when suddenly another guest at the wedding, the half-sister of the bride, played by Kristen Milioti, winds up in the time loop too. Also, J.K. Simmons is in the time loop trying to kill the Andy Samberg character for reasons that are revealed down the line, and I wouldn't want to give you. The reason I want to include this as a fantasy essential is, first of all, I think it's very well executed. The cast is very charming, but also the fact that it advances the time loop genre, it proves the power of Groundhog Day by doing a good variation on it, a variation being that there's a bunch of people trying to get away, and is well executed and charming, and also marks the beginning of the streaming era starting to contribute things to the genre. And, you know, now there's a business model again for sort of small mid-range movies. I just think it's really delightfully done and smartly executed and deals with the Groundhog Day premise in a way that's more than just repeating Groundhog Day, and deserves mention in part because it establishes Groundhog Day not only as a film, but as a genre.
And now for a movie that, again, I'm not as fond of as you, but I think in this case, I'm on the other side of the critical consensus. Barbie 2023 by the great and wonderful Greta Gerwig. I thought that it got a lot of things right, but didn't nail the assignment. You, conversely, along with most critics, loved it to the heavens. So certainly it is a essential 2023 movie, and it does deal with the great American fantasy of Barbie and Ken in a way that even Toy Story 3 did not. So take it away, Robin. Tell us why Margot Robbie and Ryan Gosling are the Ken and Barbie for the ages.
Well, it's not only their performances and their both of them nailing the roles, but also the fact that the film is both a big budget, successful bit of popular cinema, but also structurally interesting in that it's like it's an essay film that knocked them over at the box office. I think it resolves or deals with the ambivalence of women's feelings toward Barbie in both loving and hating Barbie. And I think it has a lot of smart things to say about commercialization and character and gender roles while still always being wild and entertaining and unexpected. It has more of a almost sort of a skit style structure, which may be what you're responding to, wondering whether it stuck the landing or not. But actually, I think given its structural constraints, really delivers, and I don't think you could possibly talk about consequential fantasy films without mentioning it. So we have almost wrapped up our Fantasy Film Essentials series. I have a few more things to mention next week. There may be a bit of an indie renaissance coming along to start supplying fantasy films again, but we'll get to that then. And now it's time for another Hut and/or segment. The British are coming! The British are coming!
In Flag Bearer Games' exciting Revolutionary War role-playing game, Nations and Cannons.
Thoroughly researched and beautifully illustrated in Nations and Cannons, you play as spies, skirmishers, and saboteurs in the battle for the future of the 13 colonies.
The new campaign guide, The American Crisis, War in the North, covers the early actions of the war with historical adventures, setting information, and a fiendish Hessian plot.
Nations and Cannons is 5e compatible and focuses on unconventional heroes from underrepresented perspectives.
Educators can get a copy of the core book for use in the classroom absolutely free.
The American Crisis is now fully available in print as well as PDF.
Visit nationsandcannons.com to check out a free adventure chapter and the quick start guide.
The bubbling of the beakers, the bunsening of the bunsens, and the careful DNA analysis of a weird bird tell us that we're once again going to have fun with science. A beloved Patreon backer, Irene Desay, wants to know about the grugey. Since we're talking weird species, there's a new kind of avian creature in Texas, a hybrid of deceptively cute appearance, a grugey. Surely this is a monster biding its time. And indeed, yes, Ken, I originally thought this was a Liptony, but if you've captured it, tagged it, have pictures of it, have its DNA profile, it's not a cryptid. It's a real, possibly one-off animal, which you're going to tell us a little bit more about.
Yeah, the names have gone grugey or blean jay because this is the hybrid of a blue jay father and a green jay mother found in the backyard in suburban San Antonio, Texas, 2023, captured, banded, and blood sampled and then released by the ecologist and then PhD candidate Brian Stokes of UT Austin. The grugey has blue wings, white chest and wingtips, a black head without a crest. He has a blue chin. He combines the appearance, therefore, of a blue jay, which is basically what his coloring is, and a green jay, which is basically what the pattern of at least the upper half of his plumage is. The bottom half of his plumage is more blue jay similar. And according to the scientific paper that Stokes co-wrote, the hybrid produced vocalizations similar to common blue jay calls, usually in response to blue jay vocalizations and activity. The hybrid also produced bill clicks and two-tone low rattling vocalizations typical of green jays in Texas.
So it's bilingual.
Bilingual. The blue jay lives, obviously, in the temperate north of North America, had never been seen particularly west of Houston, where things get hot and gross. The green jay goes all the way from Honduras up into the Rio Grande Valley. And so there used to be like hundreds of miles between the blue jay and the green jay. But as suburbanization, which is the real key to a blue jay's habitat, is there a backyard with loose hot dog buns, extends west and south. Therefore, the blue jays moved west and south. As Texas has gotten hotter, the green jay has gone north. And so now their ranges overlap. And in fact, they are seen in the same areas in a little strip right between the ranges. And I guess, you know, love happens and thence the grugey. Now, this is not the first ever grugey. They had hybridized one in 1965 for reasons in Fort Worth, where I guess they were bored in Fort Worth. But this will be the first wild grugey. And these jays, although they're both called jays, they're not even the same genus. They're different genera, and those genera diverged evolutionarily 7.5 million years ago. But of the 11 known hybrid New World jays, so it's not entirely a one-off, the two that crossed genera go back almost that long to 6.8 million. So this is not an overwhelming gap for a blue jay. Blue jays have a big Romeo and Juliet attitude, I guess.
Right. And once again, proving that species is a human construct and
right.
Perhaps even genera in this case. So climate change is changing the ranges of different animals, and sometimes it will cause their habitats to overlap as it is here or as it is with grizzlies and polar bears. So there are now hybrids of that. Those are two animals who I do not want getting together.
No, that seems like a bad attitude. That's a daywalker situation right there.
Yeah, but that's happening as well. Another recent hybrid bird discovery is the rockaroni, who's a combination of the rockhopper and macaroni penguins. Their nesting areas don't usually overlap, but when they do, boy howdy. Borneo has another example of a not even the same genus hybrid, and that's a primate, the mystery monkey. It's so weird, it just has the name mystery monkey, which is a half proboscis monkey, half langur.
They tried to make langoscus work, but it just didn't.
It didn't. There are hybrids between narwhals and beluga whales. Three of them were shot in the 1980s, which I think has discouraged them from making themselves known.
Yeah.
In the Amazon, there's a full-fledged hybrid species. So there's a step you have to take to go from being a hybrid to a hybrid species, which is that there are enough of you to form a breeding pool. And then you stop breeding with both of your original ancestors. And that has been the case for the golden manakin, which is a bird, which is a hybrid of the snow-capped manakin and the opal-crowned manakin. So that's kind of interesting. And then we get, of course, to the canines, which is just a cornucopia of genetic plasticity. So a dog fox showed up in Brazil in 2021. But that hybrid species that's really on the march are wolf combos. Wolf, of course, is where all the canines come from in the first place. So they're just sort of headed backwards along the evolutionary cycle there. The wolf dog has gotten big in both Greece and in my home province of Ontario. And the coy wolf also has come out of Ontario and is spreading rapidly.
And the coy dog is very common in North America as well, as you get, you know, your feral dogs and your coyotes blending up and become coy dogs. So
yeah, sometimes even stray dogs will wind up joining coyote packs. So right. All sorts of things can happen.
Social hybridization, which is another thing that happens in Texas, where they have spotted green jays just as part of blue jay flocks and vice versa. So it is that same sort of running with the pack mentality. If you're the only green jay around, you got to hang with the blues just to get your share of hot dog pieces.
Yeah. And then they get married. And
yeah,
kids.
Love blossoms. So back when I thought this was an Liptony hut, Robin, I did a little bit of research on the magic of the blue jay, the myth of the blue jay.
Right, because we still have to answer Irene's question about, is this a monster?
Right,
and yeah. Since this podcast is this podcast, the answer is yes. But how?
Yeah, of course it's a monster. How did you not know that? So blue jays are generally problem animals. There is a Roman or possibly even Greek classification that says the sweet-voiced birds belong to Jupiter. These are the good birds. Coarse-voiced birds belong to Saturn, which means that they are birds of sort of a liminal quality. And you can think of the ravens of Odin as sort of the paradigmatic coarse-voiced Saturn bird. But the blue jays also have a coarse voice, and they yell, and they're problematic, and they're kind of cute and fun. So they become sort of your trickster bird. And this trickster role for the blue jay is all over North American legend. Various lore likes to bring out the sort of downside of the trickster as opposed to the happy side of the trickster. The happiest legend about the blue jay that I've found is one that was gathered probably around the turn of the century from an unknown and unlocated African American source. But they put the blue jay as one of the earth divers. And this is a myth that goes all the way back to Central Asia, you know, in the, you know, 10th or 11th century BC. And this is the notion that the earth used to be all water. And then God or whoever sends a bird down, the bird dives into the water and pulls up sand and slowly builds the earth out of it. And that is apparently one of the things the blue jay does. But in more of the blue jay stories, the blue jay doesn't go from heaven to earth to underwater. He goes from earth to hell. The blue jay is bringing sand from earth to hell instead of the other way around. And sometimes if he's a good blue jay, he's ransoming souls with it. So I assume you could get a blue jay on your side and maybe get your uncle or someone out of hell, or Nicolas Cage, whoever. The worst version is that he's just doing it so he can end the world. Once he brings all the sand to hell, hell can really turn the furnaces up and the world. And in the Ozarks, specifically, he works for the devil gathering sticks for the furnaces of hell on Fridays. And so people are like, why don't we ever see blue jays on Fridays? Which is not a question that had ever occurred to me, but I don't live in the Ozarks. And the answer is that that's when they're gathering sticks for hell. And that's why on Saturdays, they always sing so early in the morning and wake you up and annoy you, is because they're happy that this is their day off from hell. and other Southern legends. Again, most of them conjure legends, but these are legends that have drifted between the poor black and poor white communities. And that the devil will bring corn. If a witch puts corn around a water fountain or around a well, the blue jays will bring it to the devil. So you put out the corn, the blue jays come get the corn, and then they bring it to the devil as your tuition to be initiated into witchcraft. And since they're down there anyway, what they also do is they narc out evildoers. And so if the devil hasn't noticed that someone is sleeping in on Sunday or beating their kids or whatever, the Blue Jays will come tell him so that he can, get the machinery of hell going and make them fully recognized members of the flock.
So if Blue Jays take things to hell in the Esoterrorist, they could be taking things to the outer dark. So it may be a way for the Esoterrorist to get actual bribes to the outer dark entities, and to therefore, they think they're getting a good bargain. And so possibly this is where the Gru Jay comes in, because it's not a blue jay or a green jay, but indeed it looks like both of them on the outside. But if you cut into it, it's something horrible and writhing. Or just they could take advantage of reports of an actual perfectly innocent hybrid creature and then start to send out weird versions of that can easily transmit between our realm and theirs. So that could be a big problem. In the Yellow King role-playing game, this could sort of be a harbinger of a neighborhood beginning to get weird where, yeah, sure, there's initially one Gru Jay, but now there's a whole bunch of them. They're not supposed to be a breeding population yet, but suddenly they are. And then their markings start to change. They start to have mask-like features, and eventually the blue and the green go away and are replaced with a yellow. So this might be sort of a blue jay in the coal mine, as it were, for the possibility of Carcosan activity happening.
Yeah, in the great tradition of eco-horror, in which the horror exists to point fingers at man's wickedness, you could do a Cthulhu mythos, either back in Trail Times or in Fall of Delta Green era, or even a modern-day adventure where one of the ways that you know that there is some mythos horror, whether it be Mego or a Color Out of Space or some, a door to another dimension, is that populations begin to hybridize and species becomes more plastic. And this might start cute and fun, as with the Gru Jay, and then become dire and awful, as in Annihilation, where you have the weird, melting bear thing that shows up. That's the sort of thing that you can expect, I feel, from a mythos haunted landscape. Even if you're not just doing a so far unwritten by us game of conjure magic and beating the devil set in the rural South back in old times. So I love the idea of the blue jay instead of the raven being the bird you got to watch out for. I think that's cool.
Well, now that we hear the strings being plucked by Silver John, it's time for us to pay attention to the importance of theme music and head out for another week, but we'll head back in 7 days from now. Stuff having once again been talked about, it's time to thank our sponsors.
Atlas Games.
Palgrain Press.
Arc Dream.
Flag Bearer Games.
Dork Tower.
And Pro Fantasy Software.
Music, as always, is by James Semple.
Audio editing by Rob Borges.
Support our Patreon at patreon.com/KenAndRobin.
Protect this podcast from sinister birds by joining such backers as
Fred Kish.
Jeremy French.
John Kingdon.
Patrick Joint.
And Adam Balderston.
Wear this show, or drink it from a mug, with Ken and Robin merch at kenrobin.dashery.com.
Celebrate your joy of missing out with our latest design, Jomo.
On X, he's at Kenneth Height.
And on Blue Sky, he's robindlaws.bisky.social.
See you next time when, once again, we will talk about stuff.